Page 15, that's where we ended up last time. And we'll run through the general questions and finish the quote. It says, finish the quotation and give the location. I don't know about you, but one or two of these is a little bit challenging to find. Number one says, can any man forbid water that these? Where is it found?
Acts 10:47.
And number two, and the disciples were? Yep. Where's that found? Yep. And number three, and now why tarriest thou? Arise. Yep. And where's it found? Acts 22:16. And I will like to read it. Number four. Yep. Number five. Speaking unto yourselves in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and to the Lord. Where's that found?
Ephesians 5:19.
All of these, I've noticed that these verses that they've picked out, if you go back to the last lesson, you know, the five that was picked up, these are all great memory verses. You ever thought about it that way? These are great memory verses. And when you're doing evangelistic type studies, you will use basically most, if not all, of these verses that we've been looking at so far, or that have been pointed out, rather. All right, next page. We're still in Acts chapter 2. Tonight we'll begin our section of the study, where we will be looking at verses 22 through 36. So, as our custom has been, let us read the passage over. Anybody want to volunteer to read?
Since there are not any difficult words in that, I'll
read. Okay.
Acts 2:22.
Yes, sir.
Ye men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man approved of God among you by miracles and wonders and signs, which God did by him in the midst of you, as ye yourself also know. Him being delivered by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God, ye have taken in thy wicked hands, crucified and slain. Whom God hath raised up, having loosed the veins of death, because it was not possible that he should be holden of it. For David speaks concerning him, I foresaw the Lord always before my face, for he is on my right hand, and I should not be moved. Therefore, at night my heart rejoiced, and my tongue was glad. Moreover, also my flesh made rest in hope, because thou wilt not leave my soul in hell, neither wilt thou suffer thine holy one to see corruption. Thou hast made known to me the ways of life, and hast made thou shalt make me full of joy with my countenance. Men and brethren, let me freely speak unto you of the patriarch part, David, that he is both dead and living, and his sepulcher is with us to this day. Therefore, being a prophet and knowing that God is one with an oath to him that the fruit of his loins, according to the flesh, he will rise up Christ to sit on his throne. He seeing this before faith for the resurrection of Christ, that his soul will not be up to the hell, neither his flesh did see corruption. This Jesus hath God raised up, whereof we all are witnesses. Therefore, being by the right hand of God exalted, and having received the Father's promise of the Holy Ghost, he hath shed forth in this, which ye now see and hear. For David is not ascended into the heavens, but he said himself, the Lord said unto my Lord, sit thou on my right hand until I make thou foes my footstool. Therefore, let all the house of Israel know assuredly that God hath made the same Jesus whom ye have crucified, both Lord and Christ.
All right, thanks for reading that. This is the as we call it, the first gospel sermon as recorded for us. And this is the sermon that Peter delivered to them that were accusing them of being drunk and all these other things that we talked about last week or that we've seen from the previous few verses. And now he is making the defense for Jesus. Now, question number one says, what did Peter preach about?
Jesus of Nazareth.
Jesus of Nazareth.
An interesting point, if I can interject.
Go ahead.
Back when Peter said, these men are not drunk, did you suppose?
Yes.
It was not the custom of the Jews to eat before 12 o'clock, especially on days that where they had made sacrifices.
The three meal a day concept is an American concept. It's most of the world does not honor that at all. It's usually two or one meal.
In my study, I found that out that was one of the custom. Well, I said custom. That was one of the things, and it even went in about this was the harvest season for grapes, for wine.
What's that?
The concept of eating. The concept now of women trying to lose weight is graze all through the day. Isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
That's one of the ways they say do it now. But if you go back and look at the history, that even in the U.S., that's not a eating three meals a day is still within the last 100 years. It's even a relatively new concept in the U.S., just like bathing. Bathing every day, that came along in the 50s. And that was when it's interesting reading the history of some of this stuff.
That's why it's important. Some of the verses that didn't seem trivial in a way like that, there's a lot of historical significance to the verse that confirms the gospel.
And that's why it's important when you read something you have to interpret it in the context it was written and in the time frame it was written. To me, one of the best verses to display this is talking about, I can't remember if it was Noah or Moses. Can't remember which one off the top of my head that was said he was righteous in his day. So according to the terms of the day, he was righteous. Rules of the day. And we see that bore out in things today where people go back and try to grill people on something that happened 100 years ago, 150 years ago, even 25 years ago, which it was perfectly okay in that day according to the terms of the day.
I believe that was Noah.
Might have been, okay, Noah.
Perfect in his generation.
In his generation,
there's a
Jeff.
Lot of different thoughts about that. But yeah, the idea is, he was faithful under the dispensation he was under, which was the patriarchal at that point. He was faithful to God. He walked with God. He was a man of God. Clearly taught his household to do the same thing because they were saved ultimately. So they listened and helped and cooperated. So a lot can be said to compliment Noah's hard work.
Mm-hmm. Well, there again, if you know the context of that day or when it was written and all that, you get a better and deeper understanding of what's trying to be said or portrayed. Yes, ma'am.
Genesis 6, but the exact verse is
Genesis 6:9.
If
you read that in a more modern translation, it's more apparent of what that is. That's in the King James, it's easy to read over that, because, or I think it is. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's that in itself to me is an interesting study. I tell you, someone who's got a great commentary on that, of all people, is Dennis Prager. He's got a wonderful commentary on that section of passage there that really lays it out easy to understand. And but to get his commentary, I think it's three volumes about this thick on Genesis, on the book of Genesis. Genesis, Exodus, and Leviticus. Well, it's the Pentateuch, so it'd be the first five books of Moses. Anyway, it's several volumes, really thick. But he's got some really good thoughts on that. Actually, it's got me to thinking more about it after listening to some of the commentary. Second part of the question, number one, is how did God approve him? Yep, by miracles and wonders and signs. And the next part of the question is, what is the difference between miracles, wonders, and signs, or is there any?
They're the same, they're actually the same with different emphasis and means. It would just be like we said, elders, shepherds, pastors, they all are the same people, but when you talk about they have different, even though they're the same people, they have basically different responsibilities.
Go ahead.
All right, well, to kind of email what he said, all of these are obviously supernatural events, whether it's a miracle or a wonder or a sign. A miracle, you know, basically, if you boil it down, is a supernatural power in action. This is where God is in some way violating the laws of nature, or in some way doing something that is taking supernatural power, a power that comes only from God, to accomplish a certain act. A wonder is something that people would marvel at. That's actually a synonym for it, is a marvel. It's a temptation of the eyes. You may remember in the Exodus, the signs and wonders that God brought there, the wonders, God called them temptations. Because it's something that your eyes are drawn to. Your eyes are attentive to it because it gets your attention. And so that it kind of leaves the onlookers in amazement or marveling, as we would put it. And so there were certain miracles that Jesus did that were miracles of healing. Those were not wonders. Those were miracles. A wonder would be where Jesus said, "Peace be still," and the winds and the sea obeyed him. And there was a sudden calm, and all the men in the ship were in amazement. They stood in awe and they're like, "Truly, you are the Son of God." That's a wonder. Then a sign is an indication, a mark, a token. It emphasizes the end purpose which exalts the one giving it. So a sign, you know, is pointing to something that is a fulfillment, is teaching something deeper. Like, for example, the one that's most important to us, the resurrection of Christ. What does that signify? You know, Jesus said it was going to be like the sign of Jonah. For the Ninevites, their generation, they're going to see him raised from the dead. And so the sign, the implication, the end purpose that glorifies Christ in this is he conquered death, and we can too through him. That's a sign. And so three different classes of miracles. And if you read in 2 Thessalonians 2, the man of sin, the son of perdition, the person claiming to be worthy of worship and honor and demanding men bow down to him, will claim all three. But they're all false. They're all pseudo. They're all fake signs, fake miracles, fake wonders. So anyway, that's worth mentioning in parallel thought.
John Gill wrote by miracles, signs, and wonders about this. He said the disposing of devils, cleansing lepers, restoring the sight to the blind, causing the deaf to hear, the dumb to speak, the lame to walk, and by raising the dead. I said, that covers all three of them right there. So there's the proof. These things cover the proof that a miracle, a wonder, and a sign would do. The next question, number two, says, why did Peter not spend any time proving the statements as recorded in verse 22?
These acts were done in the midst of them. They had been witnesses of it.
Yeah, they knew it. They'd been witnesses of it. Can you imagine Jesus resurrecting from the grave, 50 days, well, however many days, 50, 51 days before? And people didn't tell that. that went like fire around the world, I'd say, because it was something that had not been seen before. Some it hadn't been seen, at least on this scale, especially when you look at the signs and wonders that went along with it. The miracle signs and wonders, the dead being resurrected, the rocks quaking, the sun refusing to shine, just those things right there alone got people's attention, because those were not normal things, run-of-the-mill things that would happen through the course of a day, even on a stormy day. And also these other things that, they had heard of the raising of the dead, the healing of the sick, and all these other things that had been performed. The evidence was there. And so they knew it, is why he didn't spend any time on it. Number three, what part of Peter's statement in verse 23 must have surprised the Jews?
He's telling them that they had crucified his own Jesus. He's kind of telling them that they were the ones that did it.
Yes, by wicked hands you have slain, have crucified and slain. I was thinking more that maybe the surprise to them would have been that it was in God's plan, determinate counsel. God had planned that he would die. And I would think that would be surprising to them. And also, as you pointed out, which I didn't think about till you pointed out, this is who you killed. Some of them, that might have been surprising to them. They didn't realize what they had done or what they had participated in.
If you read Ephesians, the first chapter, it explains that about the fact that it was predestined. It was God's plan. If the right time came into being,
yep. And if you think about it, when God's forming the world and the plan is there. We know that before Ephesians says before the foundation of the world, before it was laid, God knew what was going down with this. And to me, that's even more amazing to think that he still followed through with it, knowing what was going to happen. And we call that the scheme, some have termed that as the scheme of redemption. Knew that man was going to fall. He had a plan for it. And to redeem man, to get him back.
And he knew how weak human nature was.
Yep. Number four is define the following based on the verse we were just still discussing, the determinate counsel of God. So, what is the determinate counsel of God? Let me read to you from another translation. This Jesus delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you have crucified by the hands of lawless men. That comes from the ESV version. And I looked at some other versions, and several of them actually word it this way or similar ways, delivered up according to the definite plan or the prepared plan, I think I found one place, and foreknowledge of God. In other words, it was happening. God had determined, the determined counsel was the fact that he had planned it that way. That's just another, we wouldn't say it that way, but in 1611 English, that's the way you would say that it was a definite plan. Second part says the foreknowledge of God. He knew it would happen.
He knew under what circumstances it would transpire, and he allowed those events to happen so that it did transpire.
And if you think about it, that's what makes God great. Because he has the answer, the solution, even before it happens.
You've heard the word prognosis before, right?
Yes.
That's the word in Greek. I mean, that kind of lets you know. He knew. This wasn't an accident. This wasn't, a failed attempt at redemption. This was his plan for the foundation of the world. This was already set in motion. And the prophets were told of it, as Peter would echo this same sentiment in the next gospel sermon in Acts 3. That Jesus would suffer, that he would go through these things, that he would die, and that he would be raised up. The prophets have foretold of these things. And so they're now witnessing prophecy fulfilled and his ascension.
Brother Daniel Gaines brought up not in regards to this verse, but in discussing, I can't remember exactly what we were discussing, but it was in his lesson, and he talked about how close the devil come to succeeding, and I'd never thought about that. If one thing would have happened in a different way than what it did, most likely the devil would have succeeded. If Jesus would have did his will instead of the will of the Father, the devil would have succeeded. If he had decided to bring those 12 legions of angels in to peel him off the cross and destroy the world, the devil would have won. You think about how fragile that, I hate to use the word fragile because I know God was in control. But just thinking about how these events happened and how they were perfectly orchestrated points to a planner, first off. But second, look at how close the devil could have got to succeeding, but yet he didn't, because God did not let it happen, because it wasn't in his plan.
I've heard sermons on this, like you're talking about. And the sermons point out, Christ had succumbed to one of the temptations, then he could not have been a sacrifice, because the sacrifice had to be, if you talk about a lamb without spot or blemish, and he would have had a spot or blemish on him, whatever you want to say, when he went to the cross. So therefore, He couldn't be the redeemer, or couldn't have been
propitiation
for our sins.
That's right. Yes. And it's something to think. Go ahead. Well, and also think the fate of the world is at stake.
I never even thought about Jesus giving up on the cross.
And
I wish you hadn't even brought that up.
Well, I'm not saying he would give up. I'm just thinking, that God had everything in such a way and lined up so well that, the opportunity for failure was all around, but it wasn't going to happen because that's not the way God planned it.
But it's like God did not lie.
Mm-hmm.
It,
and because of this, we can have confidence. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, but still.
He didn't do it. That's the thing. That's the encouraging part is that he didn't do it. He did it willingly. He did it willingly.
Think about who Christ is, the Logos of God, the Word embodied in human flesh. If he had failed, then God's Word failed. That would have made God
yeah.
fire.
That's right.
I mean, it's hard for us to fathom how dangerous it is to speculate too much into this, but I mean, the implications are dreadful to consider of it if he had failed, because it would be proving that there is no God, because God would have failed. If Jesus sinned, he failed. I mean, the implications are infinite in their ramifications. God cannot lie. He would have made a liar out of him. I mean, there's implications go on, and they go all the way back to Genesis 3:15 to the failed promise at that point, if it had a fail. I mean, it goes all the way back to the beginning. It's just, it's scary to think about. But it just proves the sovereignty of God more than ever, is that he endured.
It just shows the determinate counsel of God and foreknowledge of God. Number 5, who were the wicked hands referred to in verse 23?
The Jews of Israel?
Mm-hmm.
They had the nation crucified.
Yep, Jews, the wicked hands, the ones that had crucified him.
If you go back to the Greek, some people use some of the Greek words that are used to say lawlessness. Or without law. They did this without law. If you remember in his trial, they would have released him, but the Jews would not allow that. It's kind of, there's a good parallel, I think, today, where you have the people that are rioting and looting and killing, and they're saying that even though all of those are contrary to the law of the land, they're saying that that is acceptable and a due recompense for the actions that have transpired, and not allow the people that did something to actually go to trial and be tried under the law.
Yep. What's that?
I think you're pulling out a book.
Well, I just thought of something I wanted to look up right quick. I like this translation. Probably about as good, more than any, but I don't like the way they laid it out in the book, because they've got the chapters and stuff at the bottom instead of the top. No, it's the FHV, Freed Hardeman version, they call it. It's the Everlasting Gospel by Hugo McCord.
How does that translate there, God?
That's what I was fixing to look at.
So I've heard people say God was saying,
yeah, he said lawless men. No, this is one of the best translations that I've found. Even though it took super heavy criticism when it came out by people in the church, and I don't understand it. I don't understand why that those folks did the attacking as they did. Too far off on that, but I did want to see how he had translated that there. All right, what wicked hands? That's what we're talking about. Number 6. In contrast, the Jews' action to what did God do?
Raised him up.
Why?
Because death
cannot hold him. That was his plan. Yep, that was his plan. Death can't hold him. Verse 24, because the idea behind verse 24, because it's not possible to be held by death. It's not possible to hold the Christ, hold God with death. And so God raised him up. And of course that brings all kinds of encouragement to us, doesn't it, today? Because of the resurrection. That's the argument in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Or I believe it is, because the great resurrection chapter, and then you come down to the end of it. Because of the resurrection, these things we can have and participate in, which are very positive as far as spiritual blessings go. It's a wonderful thing that one of the things that I find interesting about some of the world leaders today, or the religious leaders of the world, especially the few hundred years ago, they're still laying in their graves. You can find the grave of Muhammad. You can find the grave of a bunch of them, Joseph Smith, some of these others. But can you find a full grave where Christ was? It's an empty grave. So that's a mark of faith. You're about to say something.
Who was sent ahead of his people to save them in Egypt, as we know in the Genesis account. And though he was rejected by his brethren, what position was he exalted to? Second only to Pharaoh. And only in the throne was he greater than the Pharaoh, mm-hmm. the king. Think about that. Where's Jesus? Right hand of God.
Right hand of God, yep.
Second only to the Father. And concerning what we have in our as far as what goes on in the heavens and the earth right now, it's all been put under his authority. Because he is the Savior. He is the one that fulfilled the dream, the vision of redemption. And so there's, some really cool parallels you can draw between Joseph. Not only that he was betrayed for 20 pieces of silver, Jesus for 30, and other things of that nature, betrayed by his own people, his brethren. The many, many parallels. Egypt represents bondage. What's the bondage of sin? Ultimately, it's death. Jesus conquered that. He overcame it. And so there's so many cool parallels to draw between Joseph and Christ, but especially the second in command, as far as being exalted to the right hand of God and all power, all authority being given into his hand. And so that's kind of an awesome parallel between an Old Testament Bible character that was righteous and the Messiah.
Verse that confirms all of this, it kind of gets back to what you were saying earlier about things that had happened a little bit differently or whatever. But in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 13, to me is an important verse for us to meditate on and think about. If there be no resurrection of the dead, then is Christ not risen? And if Christ wasn't risen, if Christ be not risen, then that preaching vain and faith also vain. So we have that assurance of an afterlife because Christ was raised from the dead.
It hinged on the resurrection. Hinged on the resurrection. And we ought to, there again, that's a matter of faith. That ought to increase our faith because of the resurrection. If you think about it, there's only one way off this planet that ends well. One way, and that's Jesus. And because he resurrected, we too can be resurrected just as he was. And because of that hope that we have to be resurrected, I hope that it makes us long for and hasten for the day of when he comes again. And whenever he comes, it'll be a glorious day indeed. It'll be a wonderful day. It'll be a day of rejoicing. And I know there's been lots of poems and songs written about it. Some of them, I wonder what some people were thinking when they wrote what they wrote. But nonetheless, it'll be a great day whenever he comes again. And that great resurrection chapter to me is a very encouraging chapter because it does hinge upon the resurrection of Christ, and he resurrected, so therefore it's going to happen. we too can be resurrected. Well, we'll end at question numbers, end of question six here for tonight, because I think the next three questions kind of go together. And so does anybody else have any comments or questions that you'd like to make as we close? Appreciate the discussion tonight. Appreciate everybody's participation. It's always good. Makes the time go by quicker.